all the companies in this space are just trying to make this stuff a little more opinionated and therefore a little bit more slick and easier to use. The key philosophical difference for us is we don't believe that has any financial value. Once you know how to do these things, it's yours. Like, you can just do that yourself if you want to. With a platform like Vercel, that's what they charge for. They charge for the fact that they have this knowledge and it's hard to get, and it's a high barrier to acquiring it. We want to eliminate that way of making money. It's not just Vercel, it's like a lot of the companies that basically charge for this type of thing. We do think if we make all this stuff fully open, it's a little bit harder for people in this category of company to say, pay us just so we can rehost your stuff on AWS.
Hello, welcome to the DevTools FM podcast. This is a podcast about developer tools and the people who make them. I'm Andrew, and this is my co-host, Justin.
Hey, everyone. We're really excited today to have Dax Rad on. So you might know Dax from his really incredibly funny, very dry humor videos that you do. I love your videos so much. Dax, you also work on SST, which we're really excited to talk about today. But before we get started, would you like to tell our listeners a little bit more about yourself?
Yeah, so my name is Dax. For the past two to three years, I've been working on SST, which is a framework to help people build things on AWS. My background, I've primarily been at very early stage companies, either as a founder or first employee type of thing for the past 10 years. Done all kinds of things. Being at early stage companies, like, you just do all sorts of all parts of the work. So when it comes to deploying in different places, different strategies, different tools, different technologies, I've kind of been through a lot of different phases. So a couple of years ago, I got interested in, like, I was like, I've been an engineer for so long, I basically avoided learning AWS for a long time to try to, like, build with neutral technology to avoid, you know, any specifics to AWS. But I was like, for the hell of it, let me go to the opposite extreme and let's see what it's like if you, like, really buy into it. And it's kind of when I discovered serverless and kind of all the thinking and philosophy behind that. I got interested in that, found SSC very early on, probably right when it came out, started contributing to it, and ended up first investing in the company and then ended up joining the company full time.
Awesome. So for those that never heard of SST, how would you describe it to them?
Yeah, so the way we think about our responsibilities is everyone knows AWS is big and ugly and painful, and everyone hates using it, and it scares everyone, and they worry about surprise bills, all this fear and just chaos that people associate with AWS. We spend a lot of time thinking through different types of applications, different types of features that you would need to build, and identifying the best way to build it on AWS. And usually once we identify it, there's all these rough edges and gaps and missing tooling, and we'll build whatever is needed to make that as smooth of an experience as possible. So we are a very TypeScript focused tool. We do support other languages, but most of our users are in the TypeScript ecosystem, and we give you, like, very high level primitives to spin up everything you need to build all kinds of applications. And we have obviously, like, very early stage companies using us, but also, like, just giant enterprise companies. So that's kind of one of the benefits of focusing in the AWS space. It's not hard to access, like, those bigger, more valuable customers. And yeah, so we just spend time, like, you know, people want to do real time. We don't have a good way to do real time. Let's build a good experience around that. And that'll go from, you know, the libraries and tooling you'll need to, like, spin up whatever underlying infrastructure you need for that. It's all done through code, no clicking in the console, nothing in the UI, to application level, like, helpers, like, things that let you use this infrastructure easier. And then once you're in production, can I debug this? Can I observe this? What are other things I need to do? Making sure we have the tooling there. So kind of the full life cycle for every thing you need to do, we try to get there. So we're spread really wide, which is challenging at times, but we do need to cover the breadth of kind of everything people would like to build.
So, like, AWS is huge. Like, there's so many different services, and putting them all together is, like, just so hard. So, like, I see a lot of companies like SST popping up where they're, like, layers on top of AWS. Why does AWS make everything so hard? Or why haven't they done this themselves? It seems like Amazon's this enormous company with an unimaginable amount of engineers. Why can't they make their DX good?
Yeah, so there's, like, people have all kinds of explanations to this, and I would say a lot of the explanations fall in the category of they chose to optimize for something else, therefore DX being good at DX is impossible. I don't really think that's the thing. I don't really think that's the explanation. Usually when a company is good at something, you don't know. You'll be like, okay, they're doing XYZ and they're good at this other thing. You can't tell whether they're good at it because of XYZ or in spite of XYZ. So it's a little bit hard to tell just kind of why, of what's going on. At least in my experience, what I've observed is the reality is it's a big company. They can be structured in a fairly unique way, which they are. The whole like extremely small teams that like do not talk to each other set up. But even that doesn't compensate for the fact that they are a big company. So things just move slow. They cover an enormous breadth of use cases, like everything from someone who hates the cloud to someone who loves the cloud. Like they need to, you know, build stuff for both those people and everything in between. The reality is, if you're starting a new application today, and if you think about like what, how much of AWS you actually need, it's a very small amount. I would say it's like 5 or 6 services and you can build like 99% of things and you can ignore the rest. For your unique use case, you might need to pick like 1 or 2 from the rest that aren't super common. Like, okay, maybe you're doing some very specific machine learning stuff, so you might use their machine learning services. But the core is actually very, very small. But because it's so big, the average person doesn't know what that small set of right decisions are. And that was like the first, my first year of kind of getting into AWS and serverless. I would say it took me like a year to a year and a half of fairly being senior already, spending all my time thinking and learning about this stuff, experimenting to be like, okay, I found the right way to do like most of the things. So it just, the average person does not have the time to spend on that. And in terms of why AWS doesn't make it easier, they try. So people obviously ask them this all the time. Like, hey, you guys are great at like mind-boggling scale, but you're not doing well at this other thing. So can you guys fix that? And they try with things like Amplify and it just doesn't work. It's just like a DNA thing. Like it's hard to explain why, but once a company's culture is established, it's very hard to drop. You can really drop in our team inside AWS, and I don't think we would be able to get anything done at all. There's just like a cultural thing. And it's like a woo-woo explanation, like this thing in the air. But to be honest, in my career, I feel like most things kind of boil down to that.
I feel like you really hit the nail on the head there, though. It's like the small teams that sort of run atomically is really an important factor. And you can see this in a lot in the fact that they just can release so many products, that AWS has so many services across that. And if you think about like, hey, we want to unify the interface to make this like simpler to use, and you're a team in that environment, well, you're cutting across the grain anyway, because now you have to talk to a lot of teams. It's like, hey, can we do these things across all these different product spaces? And if the culture is already not like that, and they're like, oh, we don't want to, you know, come to your meeting or whatever, then you're really sort of paddling upstream there. So I can see where that would be super hard.
Yeah, and I think their philosophy is, even when you try, let's say you could get everyone, let's say you did say, okay, we need to unify XYZ things, and you did get everyone to like we're able to force them to do everything you needed them to. Their philosophy is it still wouldn't work, or it'd be kind of crappy, which I kind of buy into. Like it just is hard. So their philosophy is like, let's not even try. Like trying is just kind of a distraction. That said, I buy it to some degree. I don't think it's impossible. Like I see other companies like Cloudflare that do pull off a very unified experience across a very similar offering. Obviously, they're a lot smaller than AWS just in all kinds of ways. But in terms of like functionality, if you like look at the most modern way to build something on AWS, you can do that on Cloudflare as well. So they kind of achieve parity there without like the same like chaos that you experience with AWS.
Yeah, totally. So yeah, let's just talk about like sort of some of the value add of SST. So when you're sort of, you know, starting to use it out of the box, what are some sort of immediate differences that you're going to see versus like just diving into AWS and trying to build something?
Yeah. So the first thing off the bat is, depending where you are, just on your experience, you might have heard of infrastructure as code. You might have not heard of infrastructure as code. We actually try really hard not to mention this phrase infrastructure as code because we think it's sold in the wrong way, which is why it hasn't gotten as much adoption as it should. But the idea is, like, you don't go log into a UI and click a bunch of things to set up something, which is how I think a lot of people are still used to doing things. You define all that through TypeScript. You say, you know, new bucket, because I want to create a bucket, and you can pass in a bunch of options. What's really nice about that experience is, especially when you're using TypeScript, is one, you get all the type safety, all the editor tooling, all of that. So you know what properties are available. If you hover over them, you get like quick documentation over like what it actually does. It's very predictable on how to abstract things, right? Like, we're all used to code. We all know that you can have like a single field that does a bunch of things, but then if you want to have something more advanced, maybe there's like a sub object there to drill down. But the idea of hiding complexity, it's like very intuitive. The thing with anyone trying to simplify AWS is you do need to do this. You do need to do progressive disclosure. When someone starts, you need to give them some configuration, but not all of it. But you do need to be able to give them a way to eventually tap into the more complex things. So we find that code is like a fantastic way to do that. Again, just because everyone's so familiar with it, we're writing abstractions all day long, we're using them all day long. Very different than trying to simplify it using a UI or a dashboard or something. Like, you imagine a simplified UI, you can probably imagine a simplified UI for AWS, but then how do you disclose the more complex parts of it? Your UI probably will start to get messy and kind of unwieldy. So UI approaches to simplify it tend to work really well for the simplest use case, but as companies grow, they tend to eject. And like, we have a long history of this with, you know, like Heroku. I've done so many migrations off of Heroku to AWS. The next generation of those companies probably will experience a similar thing. So for us, it's about giving a TypeScript interface to do things very quickly in the beginning. And the thing I'm really proud of is we don't try to save you from having to know things. We make it easy for you at the beginning, given you don't know anything. But over time, a lot of people in our community become AWS experts just by, you know, digging deeper into those layers. So I think our philosophy overall is, yes, we want to keep it simple, but no, we're not trying to save you from like absolutely like never knowing how these things work under the hood.
Once again, we'd like to thank our sponsors. Without our sponsors, this podcast wouldn't be possible. Our sponsor this week is Raycast. Raycast is an app for Mac that's like Spotlight, but so much better. With the power of extensions, you can unlock the true potential of your computer and do so many different cool things. This week, the cool thing that I'd like to highlight is the Color Picker extension. This extension was actually written by the CEO, Thomas himself. So you know it shows off all the cool things Raycast can do. From your command prompt, you can initiate a color picker and pick a color anywhere from your screen. This could replace so many different apps that I use in my day-to-day workflows. Not only can you pick colors, but it remembers them and you can manage them from the command palette. But that's not it. In the menu bar, it's an actual menu bar app as well. So this kind of showcases the power of just easily being able to spin up little menu bar apps. Raycast as an application shell for all of your different native Mac widgets that you could code is pretty cool. And the fun doesn't stop there. With Raycast Pro, you get access to Raycast AI, and you get to do so many different cool things. As I've detailed in past episodes, having access to AI chat at just a shortcut away is a big workflow changer, at least for me. If you want to learn more about Raycast, head over to raycast.com. Or if you want to listen more about Raycast's journey, go back to episode 38, where we interview the CEO, Thomas. Do you want to advertise with DevTools FM? Head over to devtools.fm/sponsor. And if you haven't subscribed yet, we have a newsletter. The newsletter at mail.devtools.fm will get you weekly developer tooling news updates and some of our post-show thoughts about the episode we released that week.
Yeah, that's interesting. So speaking of like infrastructure as code, so AWS does have this thing called their CDK, the I guess Cloud Development Kit, and they have a TypeScript interface for that, and among other languages, and that's sort of their code as infrastructure thing. How would you say the SST sort of differs from the CDK?
So today's SST is actually built on top of CDK. So we spent the past 2 years or so building on top of it. So CDK itself is built on top of something else called CloudFormation. So CloudFormation is a way to do everything I just described, but using YAML. Nobody likes YAML, so they built CDK to compile to YAML. So just like kind of layers on top of layers. And the reality is that CloudFormation to begin with is not very good. The design of CDK is also really bad, and we've kind of really deeply understood that over the years of using it. Everything from just like the design patterns that the user ends up interfacing with to like how it works under the hood. It is like one of the most over-engineered, craziest code bases I've ever jumped into. And for a while, I was kind of convinced that I kind of had a really good excuse for them, which was, okay, this was a bad decision, but I was like, okay, I'll give them this, which is they wanted to support multiple languages. And based off of what I was seeing, I was like, okay, maybe it's just really difficult to do something like this across multiple languages. So every time I saw like a performance issue or like a design issue, I was kind of like, okay, this is probably because they try to support multiple languages. But more recently, I've like explored other projects that are like competitive with CDK that do the same thing and have the same multi-language support. And they just did a much better job. So again, it's like, this is the type of thing that AWS is not good at executing at. Even the history of their project, I'm pretty sure that they did not want to make it multi-language, but they were forced to because there's like nothing gets approved at AWS unless it supports things widely. We have a bunch of people that maybe were forced into doing that. You know, it just doesn't add up well. So there's just a lot of issues with CDK. We do build on top of it. We have patched like the heck out of a lot of these problems, hit a lot of the issues, solved a bunch of things that they just decided not to solve. But we've hit a ceiling, and all the problems, remaining problems we feel that SST has are because of the fact that we're built on top of CDK.
So does that mean you're going to eventually start building out your own?
Yeah, so realistically, we're not going to build out our own. We're just going to build on top of another deployment engine. So there's two issues with CDK. So we'll just bucket just the bad design and performance under one. The second one is it's just tied to AWS. Like, they're only going to help you deploy AWS resources. And, you know, more recently, there's been like a very good unbundling of AWS, where you have like really great database providers that are alternatives for RDS. So you might use AWS for everything, but your database might be somewhere else. And like for our product, that's the case. Like, we use PlanetScale, but the rest of our stuff is on AWS. Or like, you might want to mix in a Cloudflare CDN, or you might want to mix in things here and there. So one, we want to support multiple like other resources outside of AWS in the same like code first approach. So you're not like clicking into Cloudflare and like configuring stuff manually to like connect to your AWS account, trying to sync all the variables back and forth. Like, we want it to be fully code first. And we want to fix all these performance and just kind of design problems. So we are going to move, or we are going to support another like engine under the hood. Like, we wouldn't build our own because it's challenging to do well. It's very difficult. And the main benefit is you want to tap into a rich ecosystem of like providers that are supported. So like, if we do our own, we're stuck maintaining all of those. But we haven't decided what it's going to be. It's coming down to Terraform or Pulumi. It's going to be between those two options.
Given the recent Terraform news, you're probably not as keen to pull the trigger on that.
Okay, so with that whole thing, it ended up, it's a very complicated situation. So we were really thinking, okay, we're probably going to do Terraform, but we need to like evaluate everything. You can't just make an arbitrary decision. Then that Terraform thing happened where they, you know, had the BSL license. But then that kind of forced Terraform to be put in this really appealing position, which is it got forked. It got funded by like a bunch of competitive companies. So like, it's kind of nice to have a diverse set of companies that is not just one company running it. It's like, I think 5 or 6 companies that are committing like a lot of resources to it. It got accepted into the Linux Foundation. I think they're applying to CNCF also. So it went from being this like very kind of corporate sponsored thing to becoming like a very traditional open source project almost overnight. So they kind of made that happen. So now it looks a lot more appealing. Because the reality, like, I don't mind. I'm generally not someone that's like very extreme about open source. I think for most things, you need to have some kind of sustainability. So yes, there needs to be a company behind it, and the company needs to have some kind of complementary business model that funds the whole thing. It's totally fine. But some things are very low level, like a language, right? If you had a language like Go, and Google one day was like, you can't use this to build anything competitive with Google. That just would not make any sense for something low level. Terraform to me is extremely low level. So the fact that they did this, I was like, this doesn't make sense. Like, this is something that does belong in like a foundation type model, which I don't think makes sense for everything, but for something low level, I think it does. So like structurally now it's in like a better place than it ever has been. You know, unless it's like fork completely falls apart, but I don't think it will. So we're like debating between Terraform and Pulumi, and I think for me, Pulumi is like a much superior product. I've gotten myself a lot more familiar with it. It is like shockingly impressive. There's like a lot of little things that I thought were really hard to solve. They solved really well. And it's just like severely underrated. I think just hasn't, again, because they were going head to head with like, we're Pulumi, an alternative to Terraform, which is an infrastructure as code tool. You're just like in this isolated like DevOps operations world. That stuff doesn't really make it to application developers. So we're like considering them very strongly.
That's cool. I'll have to research Pulumi a little bit more. I haven't heard a whole ton about it. It is interesting.
I know, it's just very underrated.
Yeah. This like infrastructure of code space has been, you know, it's been kicking around for a while. I'm reminded of like, there are a few companies trying to do DSLs. Isn't there a company called like, is it like Wasp or something? They're trying.
Wing?
Yeah, maybe that's what it is. Yeah. Trying to do their own like sort of DSL for describing cloud service resources and everything. And it's always it's sort of a fascinating exploration. But I think there is something particularly nice about like, especially having types and, you know, having a little bit more, you know, ability to test things. There's something pretty enabling about that.
Yeah, you just have all these classic situations where you do need, like, I agree that ideally it feels, the stuff you write does feel very declarative. And I hate when, the thing that I hate is we give people the ability to write code to describe the infrastructure, and then immediately go crazy. They start writing all these crazy abstractions and doing all the bad things that you can do with code. And a lot of pushback for infrastructure as code, like specifically with like actual languages, is that people do this type of thing. I don't think that's like, yes, you can do it and people do it. But again, mostly because EDK is not very good. So people are forced to build their own abstractions, would end up being like not great ones because they just thought of them in a day. Yes, people can do that, but there's just certain situations that really suck otherwise. Like a very simple situation is I've created a VPC, and in each of my subnets, I want to deploy these resources. So it's kind of a for loop over the subnets. So if you look at something like Terraform, they do have the ability to do loops and conditionals, but it's like definitely bolted on to what's otherwise a very declarative language, or a very like configuration-oriented language. So some of that stuff is awkward, and I used to be a heavy Terraform user, and I still appreciate a lot of it, but I don't think I would go back. Again, just like you said, the editor tooling also is a huge thing. Like the fact that it's just TypeScript and everyone's editors for the most part like supports that really, really well. You can do a lot of cool things.
Yeah, for sure. At Oxide, we worked on Terraform integration for our racks, and it's just like, you know, it's a very similar sort of thing. It's just like, you know, always there's this challenge of, I mean, and this will be true of anything, it's just like learning the sort of like primitives of the tools and, you know, how it wants you to express certain things and how it maps to systems. But tooling matters a lot, especially when it's infrastructural stuff, because, you know, it's those things where it's like kind of can be easy to mess up. I mean, I do appreciate Terraform's ability to give you like diffs of like, oh, here's like, you know, the things that we think you are trying to do, and here's how we'd roll it out or whatever. But so I don't know. But it's still a world better than, I don't know, Ansible and Puppet and like.
Oh, no, definitely. I think Terraform kind of invented, I would give them credit for inventing it, and that they kind of really convinced everyone that this is a good way to do things. And now we're seeing like iterations on top of that. And I still like really love Terraform. It's how I discovered, there's like a before and after for me. Like I remember before it, all my environments were like 80% the same, and there were 20% of things where like I did it in production, but like I don't remember exactly what I did in production, so staging doesn't match. And like when I left, I would have a company, I'd have to like write up all the steps to like, here are all the steps to like set up the VPN. Like, it's just all this stuff that just goes away because the code you write is also the documentation for what you did.
Speaking of primitives and the power that they can provide, what are some of the primitives that SST provides?
Yeah, so I would say, obviously we're gonna start, since we're very serverless focused, we would start with a serverless function. So you can create a function, which can just execute some code in reaction to an event. The most common place to put this is under our API construct, which is just an API with a bunch of routes that are mapped to functions. When a route is triggered, the function's invoked. So that's great for synchronous stuff. So front end makes a request, back end funds with it, front end receives it. But The biggest thing about serverless is I actually, to be honest, I don't even think of it as serverless. The architecture pattern that people generally are following is like event-driven applications. So you think of your whole system as a bunch of events and things that react to those events. So that API request is just an event. And you have to reply to it. It's a synchronous event. But, you know, you have all kinds of asynchronous things that need to happen. Like, let's say a user, let's say it's a product management app, the user marks an issue is resolved and you need to send an email notification. You don't want to do that synchronously in the request because that might take a while, it might fail, and it might need to be retried. You emit an event that's named something like issue closed with somebody. So we have a construct called event bus that lets you emit events into it. We put in the effort to make that all type safe. So you define the shape of your event. Then you can define receivers that subscribe to that event and get that in a type safe way. So you can say like, here's my subscriber for when an issue is closed. Okay, I got the event. I'm going to send an email to all the people that are interested in this. So I would say that's actually all you need, like some kind of API functions and a way to publish and subscribe to events. And the next layer of this is obviously you get things like queues because you want to queue up work. You don't want to do it fully in real time. We have support for a bunch of databases. Obviously, databases are key. Like we support relational databases. We support DynamoDB, which is a fantastic option for serverless architectures. And then, so those are like on the back end, those are probably the most popular. Some other random ones, like obviously Bucket, everyone's created a bucket at some point to sort files. But the last year, we focused a lot on supporting front ends really well. So historically, we had like a static site concept, which is for like a traditionally, you know, build everything at build time, deploy static files, like that type of situation. That still is probably 50% of all the sites deployed, but we've now added like very native support for things like Next.js, Astro, Remix, Solid Start, SvelteKit, working on Nuxt. So these are more complicated front ends that have a static component, a dynamic component, a CDN, like all kinds of complex things. And we try to look at how companies like Vercel or Netlify deploy stuff, and we like mirror that same setup in your own account in an open source way. So those contracts are very beastly and like complicated, but they do give you a very, very performant front end deployment that is like in some cases like 100 times cheaper than hosting it with one of kind of the more dedicated providers.
So why would you, I mean, why would you go with SST over like more dedicated providers? I mean, are there like other benefits that you directly point to? Is like, hey, yeah, this is, we think, our real value add over like Vercel or whatever.
Yeah. So if you just look at that example, I can speak to what we see because we see a lot of people leaving those platforms and coming over to deploying their own AWS account. The one thing that people discount, but it is like a huge driver, people just want one bill. They want one bill and they want one environment. If I spin up a bucket in this environment, I don't want to have to go log into Vercel and then like put the bucket ARN into the environment variable and credentials. If you have one environment, binding that bucket to your front end is like very, very slick and seamless. Databases, queues, all things I mentioned can all just be attached directly to these frameworks because they're not just front end anymore. They do a bunch of back end stuff as well. So just that seamlessness is a big part of it. The second thing is we see a lot of bigger companies. Like I think the average like, you know, individual person building a thing, this probably is not going to register for them. But for bigger companies, like 90% of their systems are already in AWS. It's annoying to have to get approval to go use this other external thing, especially when that external thing is insanely expensive. And as much as people get excited about front end and talk about it all the time, for most companies, it's just a small percentage of their overall system. It's like weird to allocate that much like resources and like exceptions, like by putting it outside AWS just for like deploying your front end. So for a lot of our customers, there's big companies that are like, yeah, we only deploy inside our environment. We're not going to have some random front end on some other provider. And the cost side of it is also kind of crazy. Like pretty much every... Like if you're like the ideal Vercel customer, you're probably like an e-commerce type company, which means you are public facing and you're doing a large amount of traffic, especially when you have sales or like Black Friday or things like that. You're likely looking at like $5,000+ a month. which is kind of what we've seen. Like, it's very normal just because the bandwidth costs are so high for being hosted on Vercel. And I think maybe for like a tech company, that's like maybe reasonable. But if you're an e-commerce company, like, that is a lot to spend on hosting. So we see a lot of those types of companies come over to us too. So ultimately, it's that same thing I said at the beginning. If you build a very simplified, slick environment, you're going to attract a lot of projects at the beginning of their life cycle. As they start to get scale, they will tend to eject. We just realized at some point there's nowhere to eject to when you're using Next.js, but we created a thing that you could possibly eject to. And we're kind of seeing that happen now. And it is important to get traction because Next.js is very complicated and we're not Next.js users. And the fact that we're fully open source is kind of critical too, because we need our community's help in figuring out, like, hey, they just launched this like patch version and they broke this really obscure feature that I had no idea was a thing. And like, so people running those tests and like telling us here's how to fix it is pretty important. And at this point, that community pretty much runs that project on their own. Like, we're not super involved.
Yeah, as a Next.js user myself, I have been for like probably like half a decade now. The free tier is amazing. Mm-hmm. Like, it's very free. You can do a lot of stuff. But once you break the free tier, it's like, wow, I'm just spending so much. Like, when they first released the serverless stuff a few years back, I tried to move one of like my side projects that I've had around for around a decade to all serverless. And then I got the bill and I was like, what the hell? This thing cost $5 a month to run on Heroku. Why am I like, why do I suddenly have to pay like $100, $200 for like hosting stuff? So it is very nice to see an option, because as you're right, there is no option. And it's kind of similar to what we were talking about earlier with AWS. Like, there's a little bit of a decoupling here happening, where like a lot of people use Vercel and depend on it, but they are very, very coupled to the whole system because of how Next.js is built.
Yeah, it is a challenging situation. I think the main thing that frustrates me is that experience you just had, where like something that costs $5 is now like, you know, 20 times more expensive. That's a lot of people's first experience with serverless. So now they kind of equate, oh, this is what it's like. You get these like big bills that make no sense. But in reality, when you have like an actual serverless system built directly on the company that provides those primitives, like, I have like shockingly crazy like stories of how much money people have saved. Like, there's one that I posted like a year ago where kind of a standard Kubernetes setup. The thing that people forget is when you're doing containers, it's not just one container for like a real company. It's not just one container you have up. You need to have up a bunch and then replicas and other availability zones. So when things fail, like it does add up. And then you factor in that like those workers aren't 100% utilized every second of the day. If you really look at a lot of the deployments, they're maybe utilized like 15% of the day. Now multiply that by all the copies that they have running. Most people's deployments are extremely inefficient. So when they move to serverless, they see like unbelievable savings. Like, I think this company went from several thousand dollars a month to like $70 a month or something. But that is typical for most companies. Like, typical workloads are going to be a lot cheaper. There are like specific use cases that are like just does not make any sense for, and you just go with the traditional stateful workload. But I think the current perception is a little flipped, because most people experience with serverless is usually through a company that's capturing those savings, right? Like, Vercel sits on top with 100x markup. You pay like not that much cheaper, maybe even more expensive, and they kind of capture all the savings. Most of people who experience serverless is in that type of situation. So I think there's a lot of just kind of like, because that's incorrect assumptions around it.
Oh yeah, I definitely echo that. Like, even just Vercel's limitations of like 15 seconds for a serverless function, it's like, in my mind, I associated that with serverless in general. And then I researched a bunch and it's like, oh, you can actually put that up to 15 minutes. Just they don't expose the configuration option anywhere.
It's funny, because I that one I do wonder about, because I think they bumped that from 15 seconds to something. Mm-hmm. And they recently did something else where like you need to explicitly say, I want more. But they don't let you go to the 15-minute limit that they have. So I'm trying to understand that. I think it's because, again, here's another challenge with them. So for us, a free tier type user costs us nothing, because they're deploying to their own AWS account. They get the AWS free tier. They get credits, whatever. Like, that's AWS paying for that. But for Vercel, every customer they get that's not like a real company is a cost for them. So I think they're a lot more aggressive with those limits, so that the overall cost of their free tier is not like overshadowing the companies that actually pay.
That's a challenging area. I mean, I see a lot of what they're doing is just like selling a user experience or developer experience as much as anything else. You know, it's just like, here's the value that we add in the time that we save around the other areas, and I guess idealistically letting you think about less things. And I feel like that's where like SST and similar tools actually fit a really good market, because, you know, it is true that there are so many capabilities that are available on AWS and just like pretty much anything you could ever think of or ever need. But getting into it, it's a bear. It's a real bear. And there's significant cost in just onboarding and ramping up and learning all the things and the foot guns that can happen, where you just like, oh, like typically serverless is like actually relatively cheap, but it screwed up and I like have this like step function that calls the serverless function and then like recalls it like a million times. And now my bill's like incredibly high. I think that sort of intimidation factor sort of really, you know, going back to the earlier part of this conversation, warrants more product abstraction layers to sit in front of that. And then giving people a smooth on-ramp, you know, from a more sort of like just white glove turnkey service like Vercel to, you know, a more buffet style, you know, choose your own adventure AWS is, you know, it's a good market to hit.
I think, I think we're all doing the same thing, and it's a right idea, right? Like we're all trying to, all the companies in this space are just trying to make this stuff a little more opinionated and therefore a little bit more slick and easier to use with fewer mistakes that you can make. I think the key philosophical difference for us is we don't believe that has any financial value, because it's just knowledge at the end of the day, right? Like once you know how to do these things, it's yours. Like you can just do that yourself if you want to. With a platform like Vercel, that's what they charge for. They charge for the fact that they have this knowledge, and it's hard to get, and it's a high barrier to acquiring it. So they, you know, people are willing to pay for it, which makes total sense. But our goal is to basically say, well, you can get all that for free because it's open source. Like we want to get to a place where like we eliminate that. I mean, from a competitive standpoint, like we want to eliminate that way of making money. And it's not just Vercel, it's like a lot of the companies that basically charge for this type of thing. And of course it's more than just a knowledge. Like there's a lot of things that come together nicely, but at a base level, we do think if we make all this stuff fully open, it's a little bit harder for people in this category of company to say like, to pay us just so we can rehost your stuff on AWS.
And like keeping in line with that, like knowledge guarding thing, do like the dot earlier, you said there's like five things in AWS that I really need to know about to be able to deploy an application. Do the SST docs kind of like help coach me through those like stickier AWS concepts, presenting them in a simpler way for me so I can be like, oh, okay. Yeah. I see the components, I can mix and match.
Yeah. So we definitely do that. We of course don't think we do that good of a job, and we like we just feel like we just need to make that better. I would say we do that. We only do an okay job at that. We need to do it. We just need to spend more time there. But you know, all of our users so far, most of them have been people, especially lately, have been people that just did not know about this stuff before, and they kind of learned it through our docs. I think it's funny. I feel like every company at a certain size, you just start to get like crazy conflicting feedback. Like we'll see tweets like, wow, the SST docs are amazing, like I learned so much through them, is way better than reading AWS docs. And then right next to it, there'll be a tweet that's like I hate the SST docs, like where is this, I can't figure it out. So yeah, we do need to do a better job, but we do know like something at the core is working.
I feel like it's sort of a common problem, and you hit this interesting area, which I mean AWS has as well, sort of. Which is, there's a lot to learn, there's a lot of concepts, and you have to figure out what is the right pacing. This is like, how do I introduce you to concepts and give you what you need to know without just like fire hosing you right off the bat? And I think like AWS tries their best to do this by just like fragmenting the hell out of everything. So it's like you're in this one little area learning about this one little thing, but like there is a world of stuff, and just like navigating around to like, what do I even need to look up can be insanely hard. So it's a hard balance. It really is.
And there's so many situations that are just kind of unbelievable, right? So going back to this real-time example, okay, you need to have some real-time on your app. You know that WebSockets help you do that. You go look up, how do I do WebSockets in AWS? You find something called AWS API Gateway WebSockets, or WebSocket API Gateway. I forgot what order it's called in. And it sounds like exactly what you would need. It seems directly made for your use case. It's all serverless. It seems like the right choice. It's actually the wrong choice, believe it or not. It's the thing that you would find is actually the wrong thing for you to use. You need to use this other thing that nobody knows about called IoT Core, which is like, what the hell? Like, why am I doing some Internet of Things thing? Well, it turns out they have a really, really great service underneath all that. That is a real-time WebSocket serverless thing. Super performant, like supports broadcast topics. Like, it's like a really great service, but it's randomly in the IoT section. No average person's ever going to find that, right? So for us, it's about like discovering those things and saying, like, making that the default. And like, you don't even realize that it's weird. Like, from your point of view, it's like, oh yeah, it's how you do real-time stuff in SST. Again, it's impossible at this point, unless you're like really dedicated to becoming an AWS pro. It's just not going to happen.
So if I am an AWS pro, what does it look like to like break out of those primitives boxes? Like, am I able to use like all AWS services under the sun, or are there just like a select few that I can tap into?
Yeah, so this is the reason we did have to build on CDK, why we couldn't just go from nothing, because mm-hmm. we're obviously going to do a really great job for the 5% of services that we think most people need. But again, it's like, oh, I need to use their image recognition API. I need to spin that up. Like, there's no way we're going to have time to build something for that. So our escape hatch is always just going straight to CDK, and CDK supports every single AWS resource. So you can always use that. Even for our constructs, you can break out of like the high level abstraction we have. If you need to configure something super low level, like we have like an escape hatch in every construct to access those lower level properties. It's really uncommon, even all of us building, like we build using our own product. I think it's somewhat common to need these random other services to break out of our construct and go into some weird deeper AWS thing. Like, we rarely ever need to do that. And this is kind of why I said earlier, like when people try to do their own abstraction like this, it ends up not working well, because you only have insight towards your current use case. Our constructs came about over like the thousands of companies that use us, the thousands of complaints we've gotten, all they use different, like we run them through all the different cases and make sure we can support all sorts of things while keeping it simple. So we have a really good sense of what's important and what's not. Like, what are you going to need? What are you not going to need? And yeah, I think our value just comes from the size of our community at this point.
Of all of this, just something I'm curious about, what do you think was the hardest thing to get right?
One of the hardest things to get right, I think, is actually the most basic thing, which is project structure. So we have, and you guys hinted this earlier, so we need to establish some level of opinion of here's how to do things. It can't be too opinionated because it's brittle and everyone wants to escape it. And it can't be too loose because then we're not really providing any value and we're letting people do things that kind of screw themselves over. So getting to a place where, and again, because we're built on top of CDK, and it's one of the hardest parts of building dev tools, your earliest, most loyal users are your weirdest users, because why the hell do they try out your product and start using it? Like, they're like a weird group of people. As you evolve, oftentimes the right thing for you to build is not what that group of people want. So early on, we obviously attracted like AWS serverless people, people with like certifications, people that were already kind of in this world, and they had a way of doing things and the way they wanted to do things. But we realized if we just continue to build for them, we wouldn't be growing serverless at all. We would just be selling into the existing market. So we had to realize, okay, we need to build something that could be tempting to people that aren't already in this world. So that requires us to be more opinionated and maybe in ways that our current user base might not like. So understanding when you're at that like local maximum and realizing to get to the next one, you need to like kind of go backwards a little bit or like kind of lose your current footing. It's really hard because one, you like know these people individually, you like them, they supported you early on. Making a decision that means you're like not doing what they want, it's very, very hard. But if you're not able to do that, you just end up getting stuck. And now that I've understood that, I see it everywhere. Like whenever a framework comes out with a new version, you see people upset because they're like, why are they changing things for no reason? Things worked well, they're overcomplicating it. And sometimes they are, like stuff gets bloated. There's like a golden window where it was good and then kind of gets bloated. But other times it's the author recognizing the ideas that we've had we're at a ceiling. Like, we've attracted everyone that would ever be into this idea. And that might be fine. Like, that's like something you want to, like, you're happy with where it is and you want to continue serving that group of people. But at our size, like, yeah, we're not near making that kind of decision. So we need to keep looking for ways to attract people that aren't already looking at the way we do things.
Yeah. And I guess the sort of like adding frameworks as a first class thing is like moving beyond just static side is a great sort of on ramp for that. A traditional hard thing to do in any cloud environment is local development. I've used a few serverless frameworks in the past. We've actually had some guests on that had developed their own serverless frameworks. And most of the time, one of the things that they talk about is like, oh, well, he's like, we provide this like better experience for doing local development. So what are y'all's opinions about that? Or what are you trying to do in that area?
Yeah. So the way SST got big initially, like when they first launched, the way I found it was because they had a really funny idea with how to do local development. So in this model, when you're like really letting yourself use these like cloud services, like queues, databases, all this stuff, you want your local development to actually be done in the cloud because you want it to mirror what it's going to look like in production. And this actually works fantastically well for most scenarios, right? Because everything in the serverless world is usage based. So spinning up a copy of the environment for me, for you, for whatever, doesn't cost anymore. It costs nothing unless I'm using it. And usually when I'm using it, I'm like well within the free tier. So having copies for everyone of the full environment is amazing. And some of the reason why infrastructure as code is important, because you want to be able to do this. But the part that sucks is the feedback loop when you're changing code. So you update a function, but hang on, this function, even though it's quote unquote local development, it's running in the cloud. So you hit save, it needs to recompile, it needs to upload, the function needs to restart. And that's like, at best, I would say nowadays, at least in the AWS world, it's like 3 seconds, I would say. It's not good. 3 seconds is not fast enough. Like, you like really feel that, and like you start to get distracted even in a 3 second window. So what SST did originally was we deploy everything for real except for your functions. For your functions, we deploy a fake function, and this fake function runs in AWS. Every time it gets a request, it forwards a request to your local machine. The computation is done there and the response is sent back, right? So it's like we're running the function. What's nice about this whole model is everything's like event-based. Everything is meant to be like transferred around like this. So it's very easy to implement something like that. And what's great is when you hit save and the rebuild happens, it's ready to go at the speed that your computer can rebuild it. So now you've brought it down to like 100 millisecond type of cycle things. And that's way more acceptable. So for us, like we mirror everything except for that. Even the function that's running locally, it's running in an environment where it has like the exact same credentials it would have when it's deployed. So if this function doesn't have access to a queue, you're going to get an error because it's running in a very similar environment. So yeah, I think our approach is the only right way to emulate the cloud. It's actually running in the cloud. It's hard to emulate it. Except for this one area, we're going to carve a little caveat for, but we're still going to try to make it similar. And for some reason, CDK, SAM, serverless framework, they have not copied this. I'm going to tell them, I'm going to say it right here, please copy it. Like, everyone needs to just copy this feature. It is a good feature. I know, and I've talked to some product managers from these companies, like these projects, like I know people are asking for it. Just do it. It's like a great, it just works. We've been doing it for years, and it is like the thing that hooks people.
That's very clever. I love that.
Yeah, not my idea, but I think, I don't know who gets credit for that, either Frank or Jay. So the team is just the three of us. Jay is CEO, and Frank is technically CTO. Frank is very good at coming up with like freakish things to do in AWS because he's been doing it for a long time. So I imagine this came from him. More recently, we switched it to using that IoT core thing I talked about. So it now connects over IoT core, which is already provisioned for you, nothing to set up, and it comes through and it works well.
That's awesome.
Nice. So one last thing on SST before we move on to the console in the future. On the docs, I noticed you have testing utilities. And I feel like for this sort of thing, you usually don't get any sort of like testing capabilities shipped along with it. So what sort of stuff does SST ship for testing?
Yeah, so I'm a little conflicted about this because the problem, I would say, and CDK does a lot of stuff around testing, because now that you have code, you're looking at it, you're like, I have code, therefore I can now test the code. So people write unit tests for their like CDK infrastructure code, but I don't think they're very helpful. And I think most of the time, if you look at what people are doing, they're just writing their code twice. They're like writing the CDK code, then like rewriting it as a test. And when they change the CDK code, their test breaks every time. So like they're not, I think there's like assumption that we need to, you know, write tests for this. It is useful in some cases for some like really specific things, like, okay, I want to make sure that we never provision a database that's like exposed publicly, because that's all expressed in code. You can write a test that ensures that. Or I want to make sure, I think snapshot testing is great for these types of infrastructure as code tests, because like you built it, you know it works. You don't really care about that detail. You just want to snapshot that. And if this ever changes, you just want to make sure the test breaks. We use those tests a lot because we ship constructs to people. We ship reusable infrastructure as code pieces. So we want to make sure changes we make, we're not accidentally like deleting a database as part of this change, right? So we use those snapshot tests a lot. But I think for the average person, like you probably shouldn't have too many of these. We talk a lot about integration testing because, again, spinning up a clone of the production environment costs nothing and is going to happen pretty quickly. We typically have people do a deploy to like a fake environment, and then they'll do the test, but the tests are hitting those real resources, so hitting API endpoints, which creates stuff in the database, verifying the things that come back. So we're really big on like integration type tests, and then you like smaller unit type tests, of course, people can still do. That's kind of irrespective of our framework.
Yeah, that's one of my biggest pet peeves too, is just folks writing a test that literally rewrites the source code, or like, or worse, is just testing the framework. It's like, did the framework do the thing that I expected it to? It's like, well, probably not the place to test that. If you don't trust it that much, maybe use something else.
Yeah, it's very hard to come with useful tests. And you tend to come with useful tests in the places you spend a lot of time in, like your application. You're probably not going to come up with too many useful tests on the framework side. But like I said, we do have it in there because it is useful here and there. And like I said, we use it. And it is a question we get. Yeah.
Something we talk to a lot of folks about, and we've touched on it at various points in this episode. So SST is open source, or a lot of the stuff around it is open source. And you know, we've talked about Terraform and the contention with their licensing change, which is really just this underlying tension of like wanting to work in the open and also needing to pay your bills and needing to, you know, build a company. So you're obviously building a company and you have this product, which is SST Console. And I'm assuming this is your sort of like inroads to a monetizable feature. So I'd love to talk a little bit more about that. And then maybe afterwards, just more about how you think about growing the business from like what other, you know, value adds that you can actually, you know, build a sustainable, both open source core and sustainable business.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. So, I'll say off the bat, like everyone at the company, we're here to make money. We're here to try to get super rich. That's why we're doing everything. That's why we work super hard every single day. We do it all open source. There's a variety of reasons for that. But there's like no illusions here that like that's not like a big motivator. So it's like it is a big motivator. And I actually think there's something wrong with it. I actually think it could lead to some good things, right? Because we're very clear about that, we talk about our business model every single day. Like what type of business do we want to be? Everything from like, how do we want to make money? Given if you're making money like this and your company needs to look like this, is that the type of company we want? Yes, no. So we're very, very clear on what we want. And for that, for us, and it's completely arbitrary. Like it depends on who you are. All three of us have, like I said earlier, I've spent a lot of time at early stage companies. All three of us have. We're all very, very aligned on having like a ridiculously small team. And if you look at our team right now, it's only three people, right? Most of our competitors are 5 to 10 times bigger already. The reason we want to do that is because we want to make money in a very specific type of way, right? We want to be able to have literally every single piece of code we write be open source. So even our paid product, 100% open source. The reason we want that is, one, strategically, there are some things that are impossible to do if they're not open source. If you think about these, like our Next.js construct, right? Like Netlify has their own Next.js hosting support. But whenever there's an issue with it, That's their own internal team having to prioritize it and put on the roadmap and figure it out. If you have some random kind of fringe issue with deploying Next.js on Netlify, they're never going to get there, like just realistically. Like they have a huge roadmap of things they need to do. If that was open source like it is for us, they can just go in and fix it and add the flag and we'll merge it. Usually these things aren't things that need like crazy amount of design. It's just like, you forgot to forward this header through. It's like a random header, but I need it. I'm just going to go do a PR for it. So strategically, that's why we are open source for a lot of these things. Secondarily, I've always felt like I've never written any code that was like so proprietary that like a business would fail because somebody saw it. I feel like most of the code I write, you could eventually have come up with it if you put in the amount of time that, that we did. So our console, which is just a very standard, not very standard, but it is a web app, that has no reason to be open source in that we don't expect random people to contribute to it. Although we technically have had one random PR somehow, someone submitted. It's like, it's so weird that somebody would contribute to this, but they did. So it does happen. But that, the reason we open source that is because we want to demo us using our own tools to build, not just our own tools, other tools we really appreciate. Like we're using Replicache and Drizzle and a bunch of other things. We want to like really showcase, here's how all this stuff comes together. So that's why that stuff is open source. It's more of like a showcase. It gets referenced all the time. People are like copying it and putting their own versions of it. It's great. I'm surprised because it's like a very like specific architecture. I'm surprised how many people like want to build something like that. So we like doing all that in the open. It gives us stuff to talk about. It's really motivating. I can do all my work publicly. I can stream it. Like that's all fantastic and the type of life, day-to-day life I want to have. But you know, we do have to make money, right? So for our, from our point of view, like I said earlier, the act of deploying something, okay, we don't really want to make money off of that. Like we don't want to become a hosting provider. We don't want to like charge you to do a deploy or anything like that. All that is completely free. We want to make sure that grows as big as it possibly can. Like our wildest dreams is the default for building on AWS is SST. If we get there, that's like, you know, you're already a massive company. Once you're there at a certain size, and we kind of like, we're already approaching that, it's really easy to think of optional add-on things that make people's lives easier once they're in production and charge for those. We don't even have to be creative, right? So once you go into production, what's one thing you definitely need? You need to be able to see your logs. What's another thing you need to be able to see? You need to be alerted of issues. Like you need to set up something like Sentry. So we just look through all the different services that we would add on top of any application we deploy. And we build, honestly, like a shitty MVP version of it. But they end up being popular because it just works out of the box and it's the default. Are we ever going to have like the fanciest error tracking that Sentry does? No, but you don't have to set anything up at all. You just deploy and you go look at the console and boom, all your errors are there. No setup. It's like the default option. Some percentage of people, it's not enough for them and they will go upgrade to Sentry. They'll go upgrade to Datadog, whatever it is. That's completely fine. But like pretty much every complimentary SaaS product that you use, we could build like a 10% version of it that just by default. So that's how we want to make money. We want to make really good products that are complementary towards any SSD application you build. Not off of the framework itself directly, if that makes sense. And we don't want to be a host. We've seen all the hosting providers and like, it's a very, very tough business. Like the thing you talked about, like you have to mark up so much. You have to be at such a crazy scale before you make money. The example I always give is, we all know AWS is a host and they make an ungodly amount of money. You look at something like Google Cloud, they're in the exact same business, but they've only recently started making like a tiny amount of money. Like you need to be a crazy scale to like really be for it all to be worth it as a host. But we don't want to do that. We like building nice, focused products that feel good to use. That's kind of how we want to make our money.
Yeah, I like some of the intentionality that you've mentioned over the course of the episode. So, you know, you're talking earlier about like not charging like a knowledge gatekeeping tax, right? It's like, no, we don't care about like charging you for us hiding away the primitives. Like we'll teach you about them and like you can just use the stuff and that's fine. I like that sort of intentionality because it's like oftentimes I think especially in startups, it's really easy to just raise a bunch of money and you're like, we have a cool product idea. We're going to build the product and we're going to figure out how we make money later. And you know, that's great to some extent, like it's great that like people have the capability to like get the space to really think creatively about problems without, you know, over concerning about the product space to some degree. But oftentimes it can be very extractive or exploitive or like something very negative when they do get around to monetization, because it's like the things that are generally like lower hanging fruit are often not great for like people or society or whatever.
Yeah. And again, a lot of this stuff, I think a lot of our memory of it, of stuff in the last 5 years where like funding environment was really crazy. And like we're at like a peak of not having to think about business model or even like think about remotely how this company, how a company around a concept even makes sense. So I mean, we've had like a few big examples, right? I think like Gatsby probably was like one of the biggest ones where they were like hugely popular, but like couldn't figure out the business, ended up selling the company. And now it's kind of like a dead thing. There's a bunch of recent examples like that. And I think that's led to people say like, open source, it's like hard to sustain open source. I don't think it's hard. I don't think it's hard in the sense that like, we don't know how to do it and like no one solved it. I think it's people don't realize that they actually have two responsibilities. Like one is to figure out how to build a thing that is useful for people, but also how to make it very sustainable. So I think having that, like, I'll be honest, like there are times where I'm like, damn, I wish I just had 2 years to go crank out on this ideal version of SST without having to worry about our month-to-month burn. I would love that. That sounds really great. But the reality is like, it's just kind of a fantasy. If I only do that and I'm not forced to think about stuff as a whole, it's not actually going to be a good product in the end. Like having to think about these things just like focuses us so much. And when you try to bolt it on after, it's kind of what you said. It's like extractive. It's like the easiest thing you can do is, oh shit, we have a captive audience. Let's just like do whatever we can to, like they're stuck. We can kind of do whatever we can to get money so we can stay alive. That's been a lot of people's experiences. And I think that's why people are very scared of things like vendor lock-in and things like that. But yeah, it doesn't have to be that way if you think about it from the beginning.
Yeah. Have a small team. Don't spend crazy amounts of money. Be very realistic about what your product is, you know, supposed to be and how you're going to make money and be intentional. And I think all good recipes for success.
Yeah, this multi thing is very important because the numbers are kind of, it like really makes a difference. Like if you look at our burn, like having to make enough money to cover our burn, like I have a friend who has also like, it's not like a huge company, but they're like a similar stage of a life cycle. They're maybe like 10 people. Like the amount that he has to increase his revenue every single month for the next 6 months to stay alive, just 1 month for us would cover, we'd be done in 1 month, right? So they have to sustain that. Like when it comes to these tense moments of like, how do we keep our runway? How do we like keep operating? Yeah, we have to figure out how to fund three of us. It's quite different than trying to fund 10 people. And like also the stress of like, but with us, like the three of us, you know, we're all like, it's like kind of our thing. Like we're all working on, it's our thing. When you have a bigger company, there's people that are there. They believe in the product and the mission, but you know, you're responsible for like, for them and their livelihood, and they're not necessarily in it because they're like trying to make this thing with you. So the added stress of that, it's just very hard. Like we will grow at some point, but it's going to be extremely conservative. And a lot of things fall through the cracks because we're small, but it's just a trade-off we have to make.
Yeah, I mean, I feel that. So working at Oxide has been really an interesting experience in this, because like hardware is like incredibly hard, and when you're, you know, building a super ambitious product with Oxide's like 60 something people, and for all the things that we're trying to do is an insanely small number of people, even though for a startup it seems like, you know, a decent size.
Yeah,
there is interesting properties that fall out of that though. You think about complexity different, you think about like what is the essential functionality that we need, and it really, you know, makes you like strap down and say, okay, we need to work on this in a way that's sustainable, in a way that we can understand and communicate about and like, you know, document and all these things with, you know, the limited resources. You can't like throw things over a wall and expect them to get done. I don't know. There's interesting properties that fall out of that. And while it may be incredibly stressful for the people involved and the time that they are involved, it's like, it is rewarding in its own sense, I think.
Yeah, no, it's like, for me, it's extremely motivating. And yeah, you're never like, we're never gonna have a bloated product, you know, like we don't have the resources to bloat it. And that's like half the battle right there.
So moving on to our last questions, I think since we have the king of spicy takes in the building, we have to ask this question. Over the past few podcasts, I've been asking each guest what their spiciest dev take is. You have quite many. So what is your spiciest dev take right now?
Yeah, so I mean, I have a pattern, and some people have picked up on this pattern where every morning I'll tweet out like almost like 2 to 3 things back to back, like within the span of 5 minutes. And so people have picked up on this. And the reason this happens is I'm at the gym in the morning, and in between sets, or like while I'm doing my set, like I'm like thinking about things, and in between sets, I'll like kind of fire them out. So every morning I just have like something, right? Cause I'm just there thinking by myself. Today, the thing I was talking about was this. I mean, it's in relation to what we were just talking about. I think there's a lot of, I wouldn't say, what's the right word for this? There's a lot of opinions around things you inevitably have to do, right? Like people will say to us, you guys are 3 people, but like, and the way you're working, that's cool. But when you get to 50 people, that's not going to work. Like, there's no way that'll work. So they kind of discount like the way we operate or the way we do certain things. And for the most part, I don't disagree with them. I'm like, you're right. This would not work for a software company at that size. But I think people treat that as inevitable. Our entire thing is we actually don't spend time coming up with process for how we want to work, the 3 of us. We spend time figuring out how to make sure we never become a company with that many people so that we have to stop doing the things that we like to do. So I think a lot, and the reality is this kind of is, most people do work at much larger, much older organizations. So a lot of things they take for granted aren't necessarily true. And a lot of the debates that happen tend to be between the people from one group versus a kind of different experience. The other side of it is companies and the environment changes so quickly. So if you work at a successful company, successful companies take a long time to build, right? They take, let's say 10 years. If you're lucky, you know, you build a successful company in 10 years. You started 10 years ago. 10 years ago, I was just beginning my career. I was like lifting servers and like putting them on things. If I started a company back then, I probably made some really good decisions for back then. But ever since then, I've been compensating for those initial decisions through like how the world is changing and everything, how everything's done. So now whatever I'm doing is a result of those 10 years. So people kind of look at like, well, they're a successful company, they're doing this. So inevitably you'll have to do those things, but you won't have to do those things. You're going to have a completely different journey. Those companies look nothing like the companies that were around when they were being founded. You're going to look nothing like that either. And I think there's just a constant opportunity to like invent the way we do things. Obviously there's like timeless wisdom and you need to like really consider those things. But yeah, my biggest pet peeve lately has been, this like acceptance and inevitability of certain things. But yeah, it's just not going to be the case. And I think I brought that up today because Linear is a company that operates very similar to how we like to operate. They're like our idols in a lot of ways, both from the product perspective, even from like a business and company perspective. And they post something about how like they don't have PMs, like the engineers run all the product. There's no like A/B testing. It's all about having good taste. And of course, there's endless people being like, well, how's that going to work when you have 1,000 people? It's like, no, they put in the effort to build this crazy high leverage business that's never going to have 1,000 people. So they can continue to do this way of working, which they enjoy for like the rest of the time they're there. Right. So yeah, I think for me, it's like, we should look at those things of being like, the thing they pulled off is not how they work. The thing they pulled off is being able to work the way they like. Right. And I think most people at big companies are forced into working ways they don't like. So that's the thing I've been thinking about lately, I guess, or at least today.
That's a good gym thought. I enjoy your work as Nega Kentsey Dodds. He posts, I like this. You wake up and go, I don't like that.
Yeah, that was very easy. That was a very easy period of time where I was like, oh, this is, I can just, whatever good feelings Kent is putting out in the world, I can negate that with some insults and some offense.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
This kind of reminds me of like people giving advice about parenthood. I don't have kids myself, so I'm not like speaking from direct experience here, but like anecdotally, I've heard something. It's like, oh yeah, you know, when you get to this stage, you'll be like doing this. And it's like, yo, every kid's an individual. They might be a monster, they might be an angel, you know, you never know.
Yeah, it's the specifics of your situation, like every little detail makes a huge difference. Like every tiny difference like compounds into totally different decision making.
We just have a tendency to try to flatten these like really complex things into like, you know, this very linear, no pun intended, roadmap of like, oh yeah, here's how things work. And it's just like, well, they could, but they could also not.
Yeah.
So we always like to end on a future facing question. So you're in this space where you're sort of overlaying on the clouds, you know, giving people an easier inroad into learning how to deploy their stuff on AWS, and also providing these like value add services to, you know, get insights and stuff to make that all easier. So it's interesting that we have, you know, the hosting providers like Vercel and like Netlify approaching sort of a front end centric, UX centric thing. We also have like, you know, other contenders coming into space. Well, Cloudflare's been around for a bit. You have Dino now that's doing their KV, and they just announced Queues. So there's like more like back end sort of providers. And I'm just curious, from your perspective, what do you think the future of this space is? Do you see like more providers continuing to overlay on, you know, things like AWS? Or do you, I don't know, do you think something weird is going to happen in the future? How do you see this like industry playing out?
Yeah, it's a really good question. So I think for me, I think the whole category of these like second tier companies built on top of the clouds, I think it's actually unproven. As big as they are and as like much in the air as they are, these are not profitable companies. They're not public companies. These are not companies that are like, we're going to be around forever. It seems like they are, but we don't know, right? So I don't really include them yet in the future. I think the future still is going to be, you have these the hyperscaler category, right? That's so AWS. I think AWS's only real threat is Cloudflare, which I think people look at AWS and GCP and Azure and put them in the same category. I think GCP and Azure are just going to be kind of separate. I think the battle is going to come down to AWS versus Cloudflare because they both are pushing the most advanced model of computing, which is give us the code you'd like to execute. We are going to bill you for the absolute minimum amount of time that it runs for and the resources that it uses. So at some point, AWS would charge you to the nearest 100 milliseconds, right? If you got something that ran for 50 milliseconds, got rounded up to 100, and you got billed for that. Overnight, they decided they were able to say, okay, we got our economics down, so we can now charge you per millisecond. So that 50 millisecond function is now 50% the cost, which is, you know, like insane. Like people's bills like went down by 50% overnight. This is the same thing that's been happening from the beginning, right? Like someone else will do this big capital expenditure of like setting all this stuff up, and they'll like rent it to you for the just amount of time they use it. That was true for like co-locating, that was true for VMs, containers, like everything. And we've gotten to this like crazy granular place. And Cloudflare has something very equivalent, and it's even better. So they not only, so they're also down to, okay, 1 millisecond billing, but they also say, if your function is waiting on a network request, let's say it's making an API call somewhere else to sleep for 100 milliseconds, we're not even going to charge you for that. But that's like insane granularity. So we're like really starting to push the boundaries on granularity of compute. Like how little can we possibly charge you for? So these two companies, like you're just never going to be able to catch up with them because just scale gets you more scale, which gets you lower prices, which gets you more scale. Like they're just gonna keep going down that path. It's very, very hard to catch up. I don't even know how someone would compete with these things. So I continue to think that they will be the ones that dominate. I think they also have the other primitives you need around just the compute part. Like I said, like the queues, the databases, all of those things. There's a few things you need. So I really believe in those companies. There's some interesting things that are coming up new that I think is also very compelling. So, like I said, these mid-tier, these like, I'm going to build on top of AWS, a hosting provider on top of AWS. I just cannot think of any cases where that's working out really well. So, again, just because the margins are hard, you get squeezed from both directions. So, I'm not sure about that category. But if you look at someone like Fly, they recognize that. They recognize that we could take the easy path of building on top, but that seems like a shitty business to be in. They are doing hard mode. So they're building their own data center. They're building their own, like, from ground up, everything. I can see that being very compelling because now they're doing stuff that you don't have anywhere else, like globally distributed containers. They have the margins to actually make it all make sense. Like, the unit costs make complete sense. It's not the type of model that I want, the stuff I want to build, but it is, like, from a business point of view, like, it is very compelling. Like, I have a lot more faith in something like that than just kind of like building on top of another provider. Beyond that, I have no idea. Like, I think the only pattern I can tell is we are making compute way more granular. It feels like we're kind of at the end of that. Like, I don't know if we're going to go beyond 1 millisecond, but improving performance there, improving capabilities there, of course. But in terms of what the next big shift will be, I have no clue. But I think it's going to be some of the companies that I've listed continuing to be involved in that.
I have a vested interest in this. And I think making it easier to become a hyperscaler is, like cheaper data centers.
And with that, let's move on to tooltips. Let me get my screen up here. Okay, so my first tooltip of the week is a post made by Browser Tech Digest. This is a newsletter from former guest Paul Butler. This is an interview with the people who made the Rayon app. If you're interested in local first browser tech type things, you might want to give this a read. They go into all things like building their own WebGL front end for the editing area, to them using Jamsocket to do the collaboration. So if you want a good interview about that type of stuff, this would be interesting to read. And the product itself looks very pretty. Like, if I ever have to design a room, I might use it.
That does look very nice. I'm a huge local first person. Our SC console is a local first app. So I think a lot more products should be built like this. It just, the experience you get is just incomparable. Like, everything is super fast and snappy. This looks really nice. Looks way better than anything I've ever built, but definitely in the same architecture category.
Yeah, I'm actually using it right now. So I just started, I hired an interior designer to help me take care of my place. And I was like, wait, I heard about this app. I can just throw the floor plan on here and we can collaborate on it. And it's just it's good.
Solid. Yeah, it's funny how we have these cycles in software. Like, if you go back to the 70s, nobody's running anything on their own machine. It's all in a server somewhere and you're connecting to it via your terminal. And we've kind of come back to that through serverless. And we're kind of coming back to local first in the same way. Like, in the past, you really couldn't put everything else in a different place. There was no web. It didn't make any sense. But then we had the web and now we're like, oh yeah, that idea actually makes a lot of sense. And we should bring that to our web apps too.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. We just keep making better versions of the thing that already existed.
So long as that continues to improve.
Next up, we have Odin, the Obsidian-driven information network.
Yeah, I'm a user of Obsidian, enjoyed it, used it for a long time. I've seen some recent novel AI interactions using LLMs or whatever. But Odin is quite interesting just because it gives you more than just I'm going to generate text. It does a lot of things giving you suggestions for how you should connect or relate things, just giving you sort of deeper insights about, your notes, and also just giving some nice visualizations and everything. It's a pretty well done app. I think the most popular Obsidian plugin for this is just Text Generator, which is a great plugin. I don't mean to say just in a derisive way, but Odin is really, really interesting. So if you use Obsidian and you're interested in playing around with LLMs and stuff, then definitely check it out. It's kind of cool.
Nice.
Yeah, I could see that being really fun to play with if you had a huge note space. Next up, we have PopSQL.
So I think this is actually pronounced Popsicle. No, I mean, I don't expect you to. I mean, I think I saw somewhere that they wrote pronounced Popsicle, which is, yeah, it's clever. So I asked a few weeks ago, it's been a few months ago now, I just want to be able to query my database and give my team access to it. Just because we just need to do things every once in a while, look up something, debug something, whatever. And there's infinite tools in this category. Everything from very developer focused, it's a tool to do database queries, to really high level analytical stuff. And I was like, I didn't know exactly what I wanted, but every single thing I tried just felt kind of janky, felt like a little bit off, or like focused on a use case I didn't care about. I ended up landing on Popsicle. It's in a category of applications I really like, which is they really show off what you can do with the web, and that it starts to feel like a native app. So at its core, it's just a really good SQL browser. It has cool stuff, like the editor has like Vim key bindings. Like it feels very productive. But it also lets you like build like quick little dashboards and quick little things for your team to look at. Set up all your connections, like invite your teams, everyone can access it. It really feels like, I like building web applications that start to feel native. This is definitely in the category of that. I still think it could be like a little bit better, but of all the things that I tried, my requirements being it had to be in the browser. I don't want to install another thing or have like a separate window. This is my go-to right now for doing SQL stuff.
Yeah, that sidebar seems interesting. Reminds me a lot of like Notion, just like, oh, let's throw up a bunch of things and have it shareable and collaborative.
Yeah, like we save all the common queries and we like put those in a dashboard, and then we have like a debug view for like typical workflows we need to run when stuff is broken. Yeah, pretty useful.
Next up, my last tool tip for the week is something called Flame AI. It's from, I've never said this man's name out loud, Jamon Holmgren. He works at Infinite Red, runs like the React Native meetups and stuff. He has his own live stream. But he's been developing this CLI tool called Flame that has a very specific use case right now. It is a CLI to help you upgrade React Native using AI. I didn't know upgrading React Native came with so many perils that you might want an AI to help you out with it. But I think it's just like pretty cool. Like, he's very upfront about the costs. Like, a typical React Native upgrade will cost you about 5 cents in OpenAI API calls. But I think just this idea of like very focused tooling that's like using AI to do something that I just don't want to do. Like, if this could be expanded to just dependencies in general, I would install it everywhere.
Yeah, that's very cool. I think, I've been loving these like little focused little use cases. Cause it's just like, technically it's like the UX workflow is annoying. Like, I don't want to like copy paste every line into ChatGPT, right? It's very cool.
I like the it's like cognitive cost of this for AI is like 5 cents, but like, what is the human cost? Like,
2 days of struggle, probably.
I remember that always being a problem in RT. That was always a thing.
Next up, we have Dark Matter.
I don't think I've shared this before, but I wasn't quite sure. I have not. So Dark Matter is a little editor for Astro content. So Astro is a framework that lets you write Markdown files and deploy it as a static or semi-static site. Really great framework. Love it. So Dark Matter is from the same author of the Ink framework, the React in the terminal. Yeah, Ink is delightful, and you know, Dark Matter looks like it's going to be this sort of like same quality. So just recently launched indie project, giving you a really nice simple CMS for your Astro site. So if you use Astro and you just like, I don't know, want something to quickly edit it, or better if you're like working with someone who's like, you know, not wanting to edit things in VS Code, then maybe this would be a great tool for them. So yeah, check it out.
Yeah, that's a cool detail that it like it finds Zod things and then just makes like a form out of them, and then you have a CMS. That's pretty clever.
Yeah, this is brilliant because me and my wife run into this a lot, where I just want to like, which is two of us working together, like we have like a business together. We don't need to like set up a whole big CMS thing. I just want to completely operate off of Markdown files in GitHub, but having her edit stuff in GitHub is like a not great experience. But this is like fantastic for that. It's like totally solves the exact problem that we have. Give her a good experience, but just operates on like our normal code.
Yeah, I really love seeing more indie, small, very tailored, very focused apps. So
yeah, it's nice. It looks really good.
And then last up, we have Replicache.
So this is how we do local first stuff. So our console, the SC console, is entirely powered by Replicache. Me and my wife's product is also powered by Replicache. It is such a good tool. It is created by it's a pretty small team. The founder is Aaron Budman. He, if you guys remember back in the day, do you guys remember Grease Monkey? It was like the, so he's a creator of Grease Monkey, ended up joining the Chrome team, built a bunch of, built like the whole like extensions framework and Chrome extensions and all of that. So he's very good at like web stuff, like using these like browser features, like very good at browser stuff. So Replicache is a tool that lets you build local first apps. What that means is data is synced from your backend to your front end, kind of like how a mobile app. I think a lot of mobile developers are familiar with this pattern, where most of the operations that are happening in the application are happening locally. So everything's instant, like loading stuff instant because it's just off your local disk. Updates are all optimistic, so they're reflected instantly, and changes are synced to the server and pulled down. It seems like there's a lot of products in this category, but this one is extremely unique in that they realize that I think most people, when they think about this stuff, they think about things like eventual consistency and CRDTs and like that whole thing, like collaborative, like a bunch of different nodes working on the same thing, same type of thing. But they intelligently realize that most applications are not that. Most applications have, of course, a network of nodes that need to synchronize data with one authoritative node, which is a server. Most SaaS applications kind of fit that category. And the architecture is completely different. And it simplifies a whole lot of things that you just don't need to solve for, while also not being the type of solution that just like syncs your whole backend database to the front end. So this can integrate, this can be bolted on top of any existing application. There's just a specific API protocol you need to implement to support the sync. It is very complicated. It is quite hard to implement, but if you are going to do local first stuff, this is just like the best way. And we've had so much success with this. And the reason why our console is just ridiculously fast is because of Replicache and the work they've done.
That's a cool note. I didn't know the Grease Monkey guy went on to be part of the extensions team and then eventually this. That's quite the storied career.
Yeah. I have a story that I haven't told him, but when I first found Grease Monkey, I like used it to... There was some like stupid site where you can win Amazon gift cards and like, but they didn't like protect the gift card URL. Like it was just an incrementing ID. So I like wrote a Grease Monkey script to just try every single ID and just like get a bunch of gift cards that weren't actually issued to me. And I did it and I like stole like $100 worth. And I bought an Xbox hard drive and then I scared myself that I would get arrested and I didn't like let myself get too crazy with it. But it's just so weird. This happened like so many years ago when I was pretty young, and this guy is now influencing me again. Just like he's like powering this other thing that I'm doing. It's crazy.
Cool. And then you had two more of these. Do you want to talk about one of these?
Oh yeah. Oh man, this first one. I want to make a whole video about this first one. This first one is insane. Okay. This is called the Heat It, and it's a thing that you put on your keychain and you pop it out and it plugs into your phone, okay? And what it does is when you plug it into your phone, it gets really hot. Like this app opens up immediately and you can press a button and it gets really hot. And when it gets really hot, you can put it on a mosquito bite. It just fixes a problem immediately. And I live in Florida, in Miami. There's a lot of mosquitoes. So this is just like the best product ever. Like I was just constantly itchy. It just solves it. And it's such like a weird... genius design. Like if you look at other products in this category, they're just their own device, but like I don't want to charge yet another device and make sure it's charged. They were like, well, you always have your phone with you and it doesn't use that much power, so you just plug it in, zap yourself. I swear it works. It just works, and I just cannot believe it. The reason it works is when you get bit by mosquito, there's a bunch of proteins that cause the itchiness. When you apply heat to them, they break down very quickly. So if you apply it even if you wait like 5-10 minutes, you can still do it, and it just fixes it. So just this like solved a clear problem for me, and the UX is like brilliant. The only problem is I upgraded to the new iPhone, which now has a different port, so I can't use it. I literally the other day I was like, I'm so used to not being itchy now that it drives me like crazy when I am. And I was like running around the house looking for my wife's phone, being like, I need the port. But super random, like amazing product.
Yeah. Given that you live in Florida, it makes sense. I went to the Keys for a wedding and I was good for like 90% of it. And I forgot bug spray for the last 10%. I came home and my legs were, there was like hundreds of bites and they were swollen. It was terrible.
Oh my God. That's terrible. Yeah. Some people get it worse than others. We have a neighbor who just doesn't get bit by them. They just do not bite him even once. It's really crazy. It's like a blessing.
I find it interesting that not more people know about this, because it's like, I think it's a bigger thing in Europe. Just like, you know, yeah, just like have something hot to touch on it. And the only thing I've heard of is like occasionally somebody would talk about hot spoons.
That's what I used to do. I used to use hot spoons. I would come in with a spoon and I would do it and I would burn myself pretty frequently.
Yeah. On this trip, a bunch of other friends were there. They got a hot spoon and it worked, but then like they were covered in blisters. like...
Yeah, it just works.
Well, that's it for this episode. Thanks for coming on, Dax. This was a really nice, insightful conversation into all things AWS and SST. So thanks again for coming on.
Yeah, of course. Had a good time. Thank you.
Yeah, and I appreciate hearing your perspectives about building intentional companies. I think that's something that's been a lot on my mind lately. I mean, one of the reasons why I joined Oxide was the same sort of belief in being very intentionally about how you structure an organization. And I think it's something that, especially in this time where funding is harder to get, that we should evangelize a lot more. So great hearing your experience with that. And SST sounds awesome.